Hello, greetings, good afternoon, good morning, whichever time zone you're dialing in from. This is Ron E. Peck, Senior VP and General Counsel of the FIA Group. That's right, you heard me right. This is Ron Peck, not Adam Russo. Thank you for joining us for yet another FIA Group webinar. Today we will be talking about a network by any other name. In other words, ways of paying claims, what constitutes a network, the things to watch out for in that regard. Before we get started, what I would like to first do is just remind you a little bit about our social media. If you're not logged in, you're not connected, you're not following our LinkedIn page and other social media outlets, shame on you. I don't know how many masochists are out there, but if you are into self-punishment, then by all means remain in the dark. For the rest of you who want to know what the heck is going on out there, you need to follow ASAP. I promise there's a lot of really great information, news, information that we release that is not readily available through other resources. So again, feel free to follow us. If you have any questions or wonder what kind of opportunities there are to connect with us, feel free to reach out to any of us or to info@fiagroup.com. Check out the website, the media section. It'll give you everything you need. Additionally, speaking of media, I want to quickly tell you a little bit about our podcast. Unlike the webinar, which is live and we may potentially sneeze, make strange noises, tell jokes that aren't very funny, the podcast is recorded, edited, and perfect. Additionally, you can download it, listen to in your car. I don't suggest it, though, because if you start to doze off behind the wheel, I don't want to be responsible for that. But when it comes to downloading the podcast, not only is it available on YouTube and Podomatic, but it is now also available on the Apple iTunes podcast store, the Apple Podcast. So I believe the PDF version of these slides that has either been sent or will be sent to everybody who is subscribed includes a live link. Wow, how about that for technology? You'll actually be taken to the site and able to subscribe from there. So it's a lot of fun. Speaking of the podcast, I don't know if anybody has heard, but the Senate has revealed their proposal for the health care. I put the quote air quotes. You can't actually see because there's no cameras in here. But the health care, but in reality health insurance proposal for the new law, their version. And we downloaded and printed, 150 pages? It's a beast. And we went through it and already recorded a podcast covering some of our initial thoughts. We will cover, yes, lucky you, we will cover some of the things that we discovered and our initial thoughts regarding this law, or proposed law rather, but the podcast is obviously a lot more in-depth. So after we're done with this, we will make sure that we're posting the podcast for your consumption. Enjoy, and for those of you who have not listened before, it's a great starting off point. Additionally, you go to the pages, you'll see our past podcasts, and I think for the most part they're mostly relevant other than the political ones. Sorry, Brady. So real quick, I've already mentioned Brady. Just want to let you know who's on the line. Again, Ron Peck, yours truly. We've got Jen McCormick by popular demand coming back strong, talking about all our consulting questions and things that have been coming up. Again, giving you some insight on the most hot topics that we're being asked about. John Jablon, he is an attorney. He is also a director of our provider relations department. He deals with these things that we're going to be talking about today. Alternative pricing methodologies, disputes with providers, working with doctors and facilities, whether it's reference-based pricing, dialysis carve-outs, balance billing, or anything else. Other than actually telling you what that growth is and diagnosing it, all other things relating to healthcare and medical and provider relations, John can cover it. And then last but not least, certainly not least, the Brady Bizarro. That is not a stage name. Brady is our guy when it comes to things political. We weren't originally planning to talk about anything political today, but we put his name on that slide because we knew something was going to happen. These days he's a busy guy. Up until now, really all he did was just fill the copiers with papers. So he's got some meaning now, some purpose in life. One name that's probably conspicuously absent from that list is the Adam Russo. This is an Adam-free afternoon. I do want to announce, this is big news, I was just told that we have a record number of attendees. Thank you, thank you, thank you to each and every one of you who's dialing in. Additionally, get up, go over to your door, scream into the hallway, everybody, dial in. Now is your chance to witness history. It is an Adam-free webinar. I do know that Adam has taken every opportunity to announce that he would not be participating. Every podcast, every presentation, every conference call. I'm pretty sure he even sent his mother a birthday card and in the fine print mentioned that he would not be participating in today's webinar. And yet, look at the number of subscribers. Thank you. I would give a virtual hug to each and every one of you if I didn't think I would be sued as a result. So, without further ado, let's stop with the jokes and the humor and actually get into why you've dialed in, which is to talk about content. And before we get there, I just want to hand it over to Jen McCormick, give you a little information regarding how to reach us when these questions and concerns come up. It's like my teachers used to say, there is no such thing as a stupid question, and then I would ask them a stupid question and prove them wrong, because that's the kind of guy I am. I like to prove people wrong. But for someone who's never wrong, Jen McCormick, want to let us know about the service and some of the information and interesting things you've heard about lately.
All right. Thank you, Ron. I'm so happy to be here.
Me too.
It's the largest crowd ever. This
huge.
Is a really exciting
it
day.
It is huge.
All right. So before we kind of get started into the latest and greatest of what's been happening with PGC and the questions that we're actually seeing with the most frequency this month, the threshold question is, how do you get your questions to us in the first place? Well, the easy answer is through our email address, pgcreferral@fiagroup.com. So we use that as a intake for any question. And as Ron mentioned, no question is a dumb question. Might be a dumb response, but there's no dumb questions. But if any questions arise, concerns, things that you're interested in, you want to know what others are doing, you want to know what's hot, what's going on, please feel free to email us at pgcreferral@fiagroup.com. All right, let's dig right in. So there's a couple of things that have been coming up over the past month that we wanted to bring up, and as we see that these might be trends or things that are going to be arising with more frequency. We have been talking about, I would say ad nauseum, about continuation of coverage, what that means, whether there's a gap in how you continue coverage, and what leave of absence policies you as an employer offer. In addition to those continuation of coverage and leave of absence issues, it's important to remember that states often have their own mini COBRA type laws. Specifically, we received a question about CalCOBRA. So the question was, does CalCOBRA, i.e. the California COBRA regulation, apply to a large self-funded employer that has multiple offices, including an office in California? I know everyone is on the edge of their seat waiting for this. So as a quick reminder, the COBRA laws, the federal COBRA laws that apply, apply to a certain number of employers, and it would apply to those employers who have 20 or more employees, and it allows those employees under COBRA to extend their health care coverage after termination of employment for either 18 or 36 months, depending on whether there's a qualifying event. However, CalCOBRA, the mini COBRA law, is a specific law in, you guessed it, California, that applies to employers with fewer than 20 employees. So under the CalCOBRA law, there is an opportunity for an employer who has fewer than 20 employees to continue coverage for certain employees after there has been a termination. The thing that is key when this question arose is who specifically, what employers that have less than 20 employees would CalCOBRA apply to? And the answer is that CalCOBRA only applies or does not apply to self-funded or out-of-state plans. So in this circumstance, a large self-funded plan or employer would not be subject to the CalCOBRA rules. But it really is important, this is illustrative of the concept, that when you are an employer, if you have a smaller number of employees, and maybe COBRA may not be relevant to you, maybe in your specific state, there might be some similar type of law, a continuation of coverage law like CalCOBRA or another mini COBRA law that would be applicable and something to consider about whether or not coverage should be extended in certain circumstances. Next, we received a question about if a Massachusetts employer has an approved leave of absence in their handbook with a specific duration, can this leave generally be utilized? And this generally be utilized to address leaves required by employers in Massachusetts, including such leaves like we have here in Massachusetts, like the small necessities leave, the domestic violence leave, or the ABA leave, and whether or not and how these different types of leaves should be specifically addressed. So I will start by saying that being from Massachusetts or living in Massachusetts, I'm obviously not from Massachusetts.
Oh, obviously.
Obviously. Throw that in there. Indiana's way better, right?
Okay, that's another webinar.
In Massachusetts, there's a lot of different leads. And as we have gone through our specific handbook over the course of the years, we have realized that we are very unique in the sense that there are so many different opportunities to allow our employees to have a specific leave. And each of these different leaves, whether it's domestic violence leave, which I believe you can continue leave, or you can have a leave of absence up to 15 days, or the small necessities leave, which you can have coverage continued for just a day, 24 hours, there's lots of different interacting leaves, and we needed to make the decision about how we would or whether we would continue coverage during those types of leaves and how in our handbook and also in our plan document we're going to address that. And at first, we thought it would be a good idea to have a general leave of absence provision as a catch-all for all of the state leaves that were required in Massachusetts. But the problem there is that each of these leaves have a different duration. So if we said we would have a general leave of absence policy where we would continue coverage up to 6 months, which is very generous if FIA did that, that would mean that for a leave like the small necessities leave, that you could have up to 6 months to continue your coverage, when in actuality, the leave is only for 24 hours. So if an employer, like maybe one in Massachusetts, is subject to the various types of leaves that are required to be offered by employers, it would be recommended to clarify and understand the different requirements of each of the leaves and the need to whether or not you need to actually continue coverage. And if you do decide and or are required to continue coverage, make sure that each of those leaves are denoted or outlined somewhere and somehow, so there's not going to be any confusion about how this is being addressed as a leave or for the continuation of coverage. The next question that has come up, this has been a hot topic in the past, and it seems to be coming up again as people are going in for their annual exams, preventive services. So the question is, how do the non-discrimination rules under 1557 work in tandem with the preventive care guidelines to cover certain services at 100%? For example, there are certain services that are listed on the Task Force A and B list that are specific to a gender. And whether or not those would violate the 1557 rules if you covered one of those exams for a specific gender or a specific individual. Specifically, the question arose in this case about the bone density exams. So while I'm not trying to say that I know everything about how medical screenings and things are assessed, the key to remember here is that these task force recommendations are based on experts who have done their research, medical experts who have done their research to look at the likelihood that a disease or a condition could arise in a certain type of individual. So in this circumstance, there was some research that had been done about whether or not a bone density screening would be more prevalent in certain entities or certain individuals. And based on the medical research, it is more likely that a bone density screening would arise in a female as opposed to a male. So based on the composition of the individual, this would be a more appropriate exam for them. But that it's key to remember about how these rules would apply is that the threshold question is and always has been whether or not an entity is first subject to 1557. And if you are subject to 1557, then that would be something that you must make sure under your plan you do not have a categorical exclusion of certain types of services or treat services from one gender different from another. So as it relates to the specific bone density screening, and the prevalence for this being more often found in women than a man, you are still allowed to use your medical management expertise, the guidelines that you have in place, and to make sure that a screening is being handled in the most appropriate and medically necessary manner. You know, the example always goes back to a prostate screening. So if you don't necessarily have the medically necessary parts in order for a certain screening to be applicable for you, then that may not be a medically necessary service for you to receive. So in this circumstance for the bone density screening, based on the background and the medical necessity, it may be appropriate for this to be covered for someone who has this prevalence or the likelihood for this type of screening to be necessary. All right, and with that, I think I'm going to be turning it back over to Brady to tell us some exciting news and updates.
Wow, thanks, Jen. So What a big day it is. We have some text of a bill, but before we talk about it, I wanted to say a few words about how this process sort of came to be. Typically, with a bill of this size on the, you know, essentially the entire health insurance marketplace, which affects 1/6 of our economy, you would see the draft legislation certainly be made public earlier. You'd see some hearings. You'd see other things. But we didn't quite have it happen this time. This was done behind closed doors. And so it was done in secrecy, involving a group of about 12 senators. And I think this was done on purpose because the ultimate aim of this bill is to get a version of the health care bill that looks like the House bill that can get 50 votes in the Senate. And so the less you can have that bill sort of exposed to the public, the better in terms of your likelihood of getting that bill passed. Or at least that's been the calculus by the Mitch McConnell, the majority leader. But it's risky. And for our industry, it's produced a lot of confusion and sort of uncertainty because there's a chance that key stakeholders are not being involved in this process. When you don't have an open hearing and you don't have testimony by experts, you know, we don't really have a chance to say, hey, we think this bill should have this in it, or, you know, we don't think this bill should exclude, you know, this particular condition or whatever it may be. But like most things in Washington, we did get an outline that leaked to the press a few days ago, which was an overview, and now we have the text that was released today. So we have found the bill, and that bill is called the Better Care Reconciliation Act of 2017, or now the BCRA. So add that into your bank of acronyms to remember. We had AHCA, now we have BCRA. And as Ron mentioned, we just did a podcast on this where we went a little more in-depth onto the details about what's in the bill. Literally, it was released 2 hours ago, this draft discussion version. And so, you know, no one's really had time to read the whole thing cover to cover. Hopefully the people who drafted it did. But we certainly haven't, but we have looked through to see what kind of things impact our industry, what will be the big sticking points. Already there's been a lot of sort of discussion on Twitter and from other analysts about big things that could be changing. And so let's go through just a brief sort of high-level overview of the things we found in this draft version of the bill that I think will be impactful for us. So the mandates are repealed. That's something that we saw in the House bill that's preserved. So when I say repeal, I mean that the penalty for not carrying insurance for individuals and for employers has been zeroed out. So effectively, that means mandates are gone. Now, this next one here, essential health benefits. There is a provision in this bill where it's not quite sure. It looks like they may be doing away with EHBs entirely. If that's actually how this is written, it would be a big deal. There's a lot of discussion going on, and we talk more about this in our podcast, but that's going to be a really big issue for our industry. In fact, this version of the bill is doing away with EHBs entirely. There's nothing in the bill that talks about the waivers for those with pre-existing conditions. So we think that's going to be probably preserved. The Medicare expansion being phased out, that's going to be a point, again, not affecting our industry per se, but that could doom the whole legislation going forward because you have a number of senators who are concerned in states which did expand the Medicaid. And so that'll be a sticking point. Unlike the AHCA, there's no penalty for those with breaks in coverage this time. So that's going to be interesting to see how, you know, people with pre-existing conditions, if they wait and then get coverage once they become sick, how is that going to impact, you know, the cost of care for everyone overall? We'll have to wait and see. The Senate did tinker with the age-based subsidies, the amounts that are offered. Remember that the ACA, this is based on your income instead of your age. A number of taxes have been sort of X'd out entirely from the Affordable Care Act. So the one on investment income, on tanning beds, on medical devices, those have been gone. But notice that the Cadillac tax, they still can't quite get rid of that. I think that's because of the budgetary tactic that they're using to pass this bill. They can't really repeal it. So it's been pushed out again until 2026. Another big change we talk about more in our podcast is redefining sort of, this ties in with the essential health benefits, what constitutes affordable coverage. And so that section 1332 of the Affordable Care Act, there is language in this bill which does modify that. And so we'll definitely have more to say on this, on these issues as we go forward. And remember that you'll get a copy of this updated version of the presentation because I actually added a slide maybe 30 minutes before we started. So rest assured we'll send you a copy of the most up-to-date version of this. But a lot of things in this bill that, again, are not just controversial but can impact our industry. And I put a little blurb at the bottom of this slide here about the paragraph everyone's talking about on the essential health benefits, which Ron and I go into in more detail on the podcast. And for anyone who either didn't hear clearly everything that was just said, again, this is just a general overview. For those of you who want more information regarding this recent bill proposal and our initial assessment of the bill, be sure to go to the website, go to the media section, link to the podcast, either download from there, YouTube, Apple, doesn't matter. You'll get everything we just mentioned and then some. And just a quick note, on the previous slide, there was a slight typo. I didn't mean to say Medicaid, not Medicare. So if you caught that, kudos to you. We're talking about the Medicaid program, of course, with regard to cuts. So when are we going to have a vote on this? That's the next big question looming in Washington, D.C. I got a little snippet of Senate Majority Whip John Cornyn of Texas, who sort of compared to like having a baby. It's not here yet, but it's coming. The idea is that, listen, July 4th is coming up fast. The Senate wants to move on to other big issues like tax cuts, like the budget, like immigration, like infrastructure, and they can't do that until they get this behind them. And so that's why there's been such a mad rush to get this vote done. One thing to know is that Senate rules require that a Congressional Budget Office score be made for this bill before there's a vote. So that's the next big thing to watch. I would predict probably by Tuesday, the latest, you'll see. Actually, maybe they might make them work over the weekend. We'll see. But the CBO is going to issue a report, much like they did for the House bill, and that's going to tell us a little bit more about who is going to lose coverage potentially over what period of time. Is there a budget savings into this? You know, all the important points will be in that score, and that's going to impact, I think, the ultimate fate of this bill. But also know that the minority in the Senate, led by Chuck Schumer of New York and the Democrats, are really trying to slow this process down. They've been upset that they haven't been included in discussions. Frankly, so have some of the Republicans. I just saw actually on Twitter that at least three Republican senators might plan to come out against this bill today. We'll wait and see how that goes. But again, Republicans have 52 seats in the Senate. They can only afford to lose two senators because the vice president, of course, would be the tie-breaking vote if 50 votes were to be cast on this bill, assuming the other 50 Democrats oppose the bill, which they almost certainly will. So this could happen really fast. No one really thought that today the text would be released, and it was. And, you know, a vote could come as early as the end of next week. We'll have to wait and see how that goes. But I do want to point out one last thing, which is that there's been 10 hours of debate scheduled on this bill, which is not a lot for a bill of this size, but we should expect to see at least a few changes maybe or some amendments if they're permitted. And if that happens, we'll be sure to watch that and get that information over to you.
Exciting.
Yeah. So thanks, Brady. Thanks, guys. There's a lot to talk about, a lot that's going on in our industry. It's definitely not a boring time to be part of it. Speaking of things that are not boring, I just wanted to quickly reiterate our support of the Free Market Medical Association and, again, announce the fact that we are working with Dr. Gold, who is a huge advocate of direct primary care, as founders of the Massachusetts chapter of the Free Market Medical Association. Without getting into too great detail, I definitely suggest you look them up, see what they stand for. It's particularly relevant to what we're talking about today, which is instead of maintaining a firewall between the payer and the provider and pointing fingers at each other, instead trying to identify ways that payers and providers can actually collaborate and work together to benefit everyone. And recently I was featured in a podcast, and I know on our blog I posted something regarding the fact that a single payer system is obviously not good for those whose livelihoods are based on employer benefit plans. But additionally, it's probably not that good for the providers either. And that's just another reason why everybody has to stop pointing fingers and instead try to figure out ways to collaborate and work together and come up with a system that actually works. And the Free Market Medical Association is one such organization working to do that. And I do like the acronym FMMAMA, the Free Market Medical Association of Massachusetts, or FMAMA. And, you know, so you could take that, Congress. You know, you want to talk acronyms. I think we've got it down pat. We could teach them a lot of things. So before we go ahead and really start to get into some of the fun slides, which I've taken for myself, let's go over some of the details with John.
Thanks, Ron. On the topic of the Free Market Medical Association, this slide and the next one talk about alternative provider arrangements. And the bulk of this webinar today is going to talk about, as Ron said, methods of claim payments, ways to structure benefit plans to achieve the best value possible. And some of them include, for one, upfront transparent pricing. Now, again, on the topic of the Free Market Medical Association, There are lots of organizations out there. One very notable one is Dr. Keith Smith over at the Oklahoma Surgery Center. We cannot express how much respect and admiration we have for Dr. Smith and what he has been doing, and he is a huge proponent of the Free Market Medical Association as well. It's worth noting that we cannot opine on what other surgery centers or hospitals may charge. I don't know if these transparent providers, surgery centers, hospitals are going to be the cheapest options around, but there's value in transparency, seems to be the universal notion. If you know what you're going to pay beforehand, a lot of people think it's worth whatever it is, as long as you know it and can budget for it, and there won't be any surprises. There's a huge amount of value there for most payers. Another one that we are seeing more and more is direct primary care, and that is generally based on a subscription. So a PEPM for unlimited or virtually unlimited or maybe even limited care. But either way, as we know, physicians, and especially primary care physicians, make up the vast majority of medical claims. So if there were some sort of subscription-based hospital indemnity coverage, we would say that that was something that you should probably look into. But as far as I've seen, that's not really a thing quite yet. We're not quite there yet. But direct primary care based on a subscription can add a lot of value for a lot of payers. It's going to, of course, depend on your employee base and your employee base size, but it's definitely something to look into. And if you'd like more information about that or, frankly, any of this, please do not hesitate to contact us. Jen mentioned before, and so did Ron, pgcreferral@fiagroup.com. It's on the bottom of this slide and I believe all the other slides. So write that down. Don't lose that. Lastly, on this slide is value-based pricing, which is kind of a very broad topic. And what value-based pricing refers to, very generally, is pricing, as you might expect, based on value, not based on arbitrary, secretive fee schedules, but based on true value. And there are a lot of things that can really go into determining what constitutes value. We could probably do an entire webinar just on how to determine value. But that's something that's very, very important in this marketplace where we are looking at things like fair market value and reasonable payments on a daily basis or even more often. I don't know what is more often than a daily basis, but it is constant. It almost seems like an hourly basis. Now, a couple of others, and this one actually ties into value-based payments, is accountable care organizations. ACOs are a group of normally provider-run doctors. And I say provider-run doctors, but I mean the group is run by providers. They are integrated. They coordinate. It's designed to be very efficient care where there's no duplication. They're all partially responsible for the entire care of the patient. And if it gives you some idea, CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, have adopted ACOs as part of their payment methodologies in some areas. So ACOs are potentially very, very valuable for the industry, and we do expect them to get more popular and catch on more, especially as CMS utilizes them more often. Medical tourism is not exactly an alternative provider arrangement, but it's definitely worth mentioning here because we are seeing more of it, and it has proven very beneficial for a lot of employers. I mean, the United States is fantastic. I don't think anyone's going to argue with that. It's a great country. We love it. But it's possible to obtain less expensive but equal or better quality care elsewhere. That's just a fact. There are doctors all over the world, and you know, as much as patients want to go to their local hospital might be very, 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 very expensive. So international medical tourism is something that's worth looking into, as well as domestic medical tourism. I mentioned Dr. Keith Smith and the Oklahoma Surgical Center. That's just one example of a place that members can go, and the plan could even cover certain flight and lodging expenses if it ends up being cheaper overall than going to a local hospital, which, spoiler alert, it often does. So look into that, and again, if you have questions, we can help you out with that. And lastly here, before we get into Ron's fun, is on-site clinics, telemedicine, and centers of excellence. I'm not going to spend too much time on those. I mean, it's all pretty self-explanatory. It's things that most CPAs, brokers, and health plans out there have dealt with in some capacity at some point. All things worth looking into, depending on employers, depending on CPAs, they can be great, they can be unhelpful. It really just depends on you. But there are lots of options out there in the industry and lots of things to look at. All right. So to introduce this segment, it's going to be talking about reference-based pricing, as explained by Arnold Schwarzenegger. And this picture is fairly recent, I think it's safe to say. But Ron is going to be using some of the Terminator's movies, spoiler alert, that's one of them, to illustrate some different types of reference-based pricing.
Great. Yeah, you know, so for those of you who over the last decade have not paid attention regarding the different types of reference-based pricing programs, if you're anything like me, everything you ever learned in life, you learned from Arnold Schwarzenegger. My entire upbringing was based on Conan the Barbarian and my ruthless pursuit of revenge. So I don't know how that got me onto a webinar about reference-based pricing and providers, but that's where apparently it leads if they kept making movies. But
slippery slope.
Yes, it's definitely a very slippery slope. So where are we going first? Commando. Yeah, this is, I don't know, you know the line for Commando. Remember I promised to kill you last? I lied. That's an awesome one. Very underrated movie. Now, what do we mean by Commando? Well, for those of you who don't know the slang term, Commando is when you you wear your outer garb without any under garb. And here you are talking about reference-based pricing without the protection of any kind of network, any kind of contract. It's literally reference-based, whether we're talking Medicare plus, cost plus, some other form of reference-based pricing. It doesn't matter. Your pricing all claims is out of network based on this one pricing methodology, and it's all or nothing. And it's certainly a lot easier to administer because you're applying one set of rules to all claims. It doesn't matter where your patients go, whether they're staying close to home or across the country, you're treating all claims the same way, applying the same reference-based pricing methodology. Of course, the problem is, and this is where the combat comes into play, you'll probably see a little bit more balanced billing of the patients, dispute with providers, and that's going to happen no matter what. That's going to happen anytime you have anyone going out of network. But the reason why it's so relevant here versus the other examples we'll get into is that when you're going commando, there are no safe options for the plan participants. Employers, HR departments, they can't tell the staff, hey, look, we're doing this reference-based pricing approach for 99% of the hospitals, but if you go to this one facility that we have a contract with, you'll be okay, you won't be balanced billed. Because they can't say that. They cannot say that. Every single facility is out of network. When that employee gets balanced billed, that employer may feel a certain sense of responsibility and be more likely to backtrack and try to negotiate because they didn't offer a better option to their employees versus the next few examples where if someone is balanced billed, you can more comfortably say, hey, look, I gave you an option. You didn't take it. That's why you're being balanced billed. So speaking of other options, let's talk about one of the first alternative reference-based pricing programs that we heard about, which is the physician-only network. People started looking at the physician-only network, bottom line, because most people are incurring claims in some sort of a physician capacity. The physician claims are not really a major problem when it comes to cost, so there was this attitude, why rock the boat on 99% of the claims? It really is that 90%, 10% deal, you know, where 90% of the claims make 10% of the cost, and 90% of the cost is coming from 10% of the claims, and the feeling was, let's just apply reference-based pricing to the 10% of claims that make 90% of the cost and leave the other 90% of the claims alone in network. And, you know, Junior, as a movie, I feel a lot of people, you know, think of it as an attempt to try and rekindle the magic that was Twins. You know, everybody knows Twins is a great one. Junior didn't quite do it. For me, it's almost like Twins is grandma's recipe for fresh bread, and somebody tried to use the same recipe and put their own bun in the oven, and it failed. Get it? Bun in the oven?
Got it.
Junior? Wow. Yeah, you're welcome. All right. So, again, I think that there's a certain safety net there, but it's not really revolutionary when you talk about reference-based pricing. A little bit more revolutionary is the concept of the Terminator. This is a direct contract with certain providers. On one of the previous slides, John referenced centers of excellence. This is where you identify one or two facilities, one or two specialists, where the majority of the plan population either treats there or would treat there. If that individual facility is willing to work with you for steerage, for prompt payment, for elimination of copays and deductibles, right? These are things that providers value in addition to the actual money that they'll be receiving. If you find one or two facilities that are willing to do that, maybe you get them under contract. Now you tell the plan participants, hey, look, we've got this facility under contract. If you go there, not only won't you have copays or deductibles, but you won't be balance billed either. If you go anywhere else, you know, go at your own peril. And so the center of excellence is basically putting out its hand and asking if you want to live, go with them. And that was fantastic.
Wow.
Stop it. But one thing to take note of, this concept of reference-based pricing approach with individual contracted providers with the reference base underlying it, it actually evolved from the commando approach. You know, a lot of the pioneers in reference-based pricing, they applied it to all facilities with no differentiation. And after dealing with the same hospital over and over and over on balanced billing, finally they sat down and said, hey, it looks like the majority of our people are visiting your facility. Can we just work something out so it applies across the board? And so the Terminator evolved. It's the future of commando. So speaking of continued evolution, let's touch the T-1000. Now, I know everybody that Arnold Schwarzenegger didn't actually play the T-1000, and furthermore, I also understand that T-1000 is not a name of a movie. It's a character in a movie, Terminator 2, Judgment Day. But, you know, for purposes of being explained by Schwarzenegger, we have to take some artistic liberties here. So what do we mean by the T-1000? Well, this is the next stage of the Terminator. It's not necessarily something that's friendly. It's something that's potentially going to cause trouble. At first, it seems like the good guy in the movie, and then you realize, surprise, it's actually the villain. And this is what I think a lot of people are worried about when it comes to direct contracting. And I know that John and I will touch on this in a little bit greater detail soon. But the big question, the big concern that we hear from payers and those that service them is, you know, if I direct contract with one facility, okay, I get it. You know, it's like that slogan, army of one. Is it a network of one? But if I start the direct contract with multiple facilities, at what point have I formed a network? And is that really something I want to do? Because, you know, when you form a network, if you're administering that network, you're responsible for it. There's credentialing. There's network adequacy rules. There's all sorts of liability. Suddenly, and say what you will about PPOs and networks, love them or hate them, I'm not here to opine on that, but they do a lot of work in that regard, and if you form your own network, are you now responsible to do those things? So you got to be careful. That being said, we've certainly seen a lot of payers that aren't ready to go commando or even Terminator. Instead, they shrink their existing network by carving out providers that they don't really need, and then they treat all of their out-of-network claims with a reference-based pricing methodology instead of a traditional, usual customary approach. And for those who kind of want to dip their toe in but are not necessarily interested in going commando just yet, what do? You go with this, the T-1000, where you still have a network in place. People are safe from balance billing by going in network. It's just the network is smaller. You get better rates as a result. There's more exclusivity for the provider, and you still have that reference-based pricing savings anytime out-of-network claims occur. So who's next? I mentioned it before. Twins, fantastic movie, fantastic idea. Twins is what Junior tried to be and failed. I think that here you're taking that idea of a physician-only network with reference-based pricing underlying it, and instead you're taking that physician network and you're evolving that as well. So the first thing you did was you took your out-of-network treatment of claims, usual customary, so that old school mentality, and changed it, made it new, made it fresh, made it innovative with reference-based pricing. The next thing you did is take the physician network and do the same thing to that. Instead of just the standard traditional physician network, you're looking at different ways of working with those physicians to identify more effective, more efficient ways to provide primary care as well. And you may be thinking, yeah, but Ron, like you said before, primary care, physician care, you know, it makes a very small sliver of the cost to our plan. That's true. However, don't forget that it's also the gateway to the more expensive claim. It may be that before somebody has, you know, issues with dialysis,
hemophilia, a need for specialty drugs, a need for some sort of transplant, implant. Maybe they're dealing with a complex or high-risk pregnancy, right? All those things that have you cringing and are going to end up being spec claims, right? Where all of a sudden reference-based pricing matters because somebody's in a hospital. It's possible and highly likely that that person first visited someone who would be in that physician network. So maybe it behooves you to look at that, not as necessarily the cost driver, but the gateway to the cost driver. And how do we impact those high costs down the line by working with specific physicians, primary care, that we can trust, that work with our plan and help us coordinate care ahead of time. And I believe that direct primary care, DPC, is one of those methodologies that's getting a lot of airtime now, and it's certainly something to consider. The Predator, I love it, get to the medically necessary CHOPPA. You know, it's funny, too, because I'm sure when we talk about the major cost drivers, the med flight, the air ambulance, that's always going to be something that you think of. And lo and behold, the Predator. This is a good one, John. Credit to you, buddy. This is where you're applying reference-based pricing only to certain high-cost services. Another word, a synonym for this, carve-outs, right? Dialysis carve-outs, tapping into networks specifically for the purchasing of high-cost drugs, hemophilia, right, the factor drugs, other specialty drugs, biologics and chemotherapy and cancer treatment. That's another big one. You know, you hear a lot about the Hep C treatment and the Health City and the Cayman Islands. So, again, you're certainly seeing a form of reference-based pricing that instead of changing how you price all claims or even out-of-network claims, they're specifically targeting particular types of claims that are cost drivers. And we certainly do a lot of work with a lot of really intelligent people who specialize in each of these. So if you have a particular type of high-cost claim driver that's causing you a lot of pain and you want to carve it out without going anywhere from Commando to Terminator to Junior, you just want to be the Predator and eliminate those high-cost claims, again, let us know, and we'll let you know if there's anybody who's specifically targeting that source of pain. So let's quickly just talk about now what's been sort of underlying all of those examples, which is the idea of direct contracting, right? If I'm going to use reference-based pricing for all of my out-of-network claims, That assumes then that there must be someone who's in-network or contracted. And as John will tell you, there's a huge difference between someone being in-network and somebody being contracted. If I have one provider under contract, that doesn't mean they're in a network because there is no network, right? So it's important to understand the difference, the semantics. But it's also important to understand at one point are you potentially going to cross over that line into contracting, like I mentioned before. But we do know that contracting can be very useful, particularly in certain geographic areas, particularly when there's some competition. Hospitals are businesses too. They're looking to fill beds. And if you can get them steerage and you can get them prompt payment and you can offer them other things that are valuable to them, they are willing to negotiate a deal with you, especially when it means that they don't have to pursue patients for money, knowing that they're never going to get anything, that they're going to have to send uncollected bills to collections and take pennies on the dollar, and these other issues that are costly for them. They can avoid it, and you can get somebody under contract for a great rate. Direct contracting and reference-based pricing really are like cookies and milk if you can get it done. But at the same time, the question keeps coming up, if I have multiple contracts, at what point have I crossed into that area of narrow networking, and is that something I'm willing to do? Maybe you are. Narrow networks with reference-based pricing underlying it is a great approach, but there are a lot of technicalities and things you need to take into consideration that you wouldn't necessarily need to consider when dealing with direct contracts. There are a lot of laws that apply to networks that wouldn't apply if you had one or two facilities under contract. So to talk about this potential pitfall and issue, let me turn it right back over to John Javanon. John?
Thanks, Ron. When we talk about networks, there are potentially a lot of moving parts. We are in a very complex industry, and the state laws that govern networks and network contracting and network access can get very, very complex as well, as many state laws do. So creating a network is something that we advise all our clients to watch out for unless you are specifically trying to create a network pursuant to state law. Signing contracts with many different facilities does not a network create. if you sign contracts with facilities, what you are doing is creating direct contracts. A network is something very, very different. And one or some of the criteria that really define a network are primarily whether the entity who is creating this network or group of contracts or whatever it is receiving money for these contracts. If you are receiving some sort of access fee, it is basically a network access fee, and it's kind of hard to get around that just because you are essentially leasing that network. You're leasing the access that you have procured when you receive money for it. And on the other hand, if you are signing contracts either on a plan's behalf, as in not on your own behalf, or if you are signing contracts just to bolster your own service offerings as part of your normal TPA or broker operations, fantastic. That will generally not be viewed as a network unless you start charging people or other facilities for access by participating. So, like I said, it's kind of intuitive to want to charge for this because when you do something great and you spend time and energy on it, you want to make money off of it. Well, creating a network is not the end of the world, but it is something that most CPAs want to avoid just because it's complicated and there are a lot of state laws and it's generally something that CPAs are not super used to. So, when you're amassing contracts, by all means, get as many providers to accept reference-based pricing as possible. But once you have those contracts, our general advice is kind of keep them to yourself. Keep them for your own business. Don't lease them to other TPAs. Don't just try to make a quick buck. It's easiest and best to kind of just get those contracts for your own clients' use and make the best of them that way. I mean, state laws, some things are credentialing and any willing provider laws and taxes and lots of other fun things that you just don't want to have to deal with. So I will just breeze through this. I mean, we have spoken about it on a previous webinar. I believe it was December 2000. No, that doesn't make sense. I don't know. Sometime in 2016.
That was so long ago.
Yeah. We'll send it out in the email when we send a copy of this, just a note of which one to look at. But essentially, the Department of Labor has come out with certain regulations regarding network adequacy. Now, this will not apply if the particular group has access to an adequate number of providers that will accept the reference price. What constitutes an adequate number? Great question. I'm glad you asked. It totally depends on the circumstances. If there are four providers in a given area and participants really only use those four, if you have contracts with two of them, will that be adequate? I don't know, but my instinct says yes. If you have contracts with one of them, will that be adequate? I don't know, but it's probably less certain than if you have two, et cetera. The guidance is really very unspecific just because every situation is different. But what the Department of Labor has decreed is that if a plan is doing what Ron called commando, if a plan has no contracts whatsoever, is the plan permitted to allow patients to be balance billed by giving them no choice of providers who won't balance bill them? No, the plan is not permitted to allow it. The plan has to settle claims, and settling a claim doesn't necessarily entail creating contracts or a network or anything like that, but settling claims after the fact can be just as effective because patients need to have options to not be balance billed into oblivion, essentially. Oh, sorry, I skipped that slide. All right, and one of the major things that we talk about all the time here at the FIA Group is that you have to ensure that the plan document supports whatever it is you're choosing to do. If you want to use a narrow network, great. If you want to go commando, fantastic. Make sure your plan document says it. You need to be able to defend yourself and defend the pricing. So the three bullets here could not be more clear, could not be more important. And, lastly, before I turn it back over to Ron for the finale, you have to look at other contracts as well. I cannot tell you how many times we see clients using reference-based pricing methodologies when there's a contract in place. If there's a contract to pay a specified network rate, you cannot use reference-based pricing unless the contract allows it. You need to make sure what you're doing complies with the plan document and whatever other contracts you've signed. Are you in league with an ASO? Are you using one of the BUCAs? Check your contract. You might not be allowed to do what you're doing, and then you might be backtracking, and things can go awry. We can tell you that firsthand. So PPO contracts, administrative services agreements, ASO agreements, whatever documents you have, please read them or send them to us and we'll read them. That's what we do all day. We read contracts. We're happy to help.
You know, I'm glad that you bring up contracts, John, because it's very relevant to this specific story here. You know, when you're dealing with a plan in this example where based on the terms of the plan, based on the terms of the contract, the network contract, more important than the plan document here, there are certain things that the plan could and could not do. So when you have an individual who wants to receive surgery and undergo the surgery at one facility, but the network contract and the plan document indicate the only way the claims would be covered by the plan is if that patient goes to another facility, it was an option for this individual to go to the facility they prefer. And because it was so much less expensive, the employer, not the plan, the employer reimburses them. Now, there are tax implications. It's not the same as a plan expenditure. But at the same time, if it creates savings, it worked out in that particular instance. But again, knowing to send the person and have them pay out of pocket and reimburse them from the employer's assets rather than have them go and reimburse them using plan assets is based completely on a full and complete assessment of the network contract and understanding what you could and could not do. This is going to matter not only when you talk about what's in the language, but also who signed it. If the employer is the one who signed the network contract, does that mean the employer is bound by the terms of the network contract? Does it mean that the plan is not? Does it mean that both the plan and the employer are bound by the terms of the contract? What if the TPA is the one who signed it? What does that mean for the plan? What does that mean for the employer? There's so much that goes into it, and it's all preemptive assessment. So while all of these are really innovative, really cool ways to contain costs, before you do anything, you need to make sure you're reviewing your plan document, your stop-loss policy, your administrative services agreement, and any and all network contracts that may apply, not only for the terms that are in there, but to see who signed what and who's responsible for what. So what other big costs could we talk about? Well, dialysis and air ambulance, we already mentioned those before on one of the slides, the Predator slide, right? So dialysis, obviously, probably one of the biggest carve-out examples that there is in our industry today, and with good reason. If done properly, a dialysis carve-out program will work. If done properly. If there are certain issues in play and you don't spot it and you start carving out dialysis, it can come back to bite you big time. So before you go and implement a program like that, make sure that either we or somebody else is doing all the analysis, all the assessment, and ensuring all the pieces are in the right place before you start. Air ambulance. There was recently an article in, I think, Consumer Reports, just mainstream magazine people are reading, right, about air ambulance and the high cost and the fact that these federal laws which prevent any kind of regulation in air and flight transport, literally air ambulance is claiming to be protected by the same laws as your commercial airline flight to Maui. And as it's written currently, they're able to get away with that. And this article went into how it's insane, the prices that are being charged and how people are being bankrupt. And where normally when you read mainstream articles about the cost of healthcare, health insurance is usually cast as the bad guy, right? Boo you. But in this particular instance, they were very kind to the payer and really focused in on the fact that these costs are out of control and it makes no sense. So it's a good read if you could find it. But again, there are people out there. We know them. We have access to tools that can help you carve out air ambulance. But other things, you know, that you're hearing about, specialty drugs, again, there are options that are out there. And just excessive or egregious out-of-network charges, again, you need to figure out how you're going to pay these, how you're going to price these, how you're going to benefit. Because, again, if you're going to approach any of these costs, if you're looking to carve out dialysis or you're looking to apply reference-based pricing to out-of-network claims, it doesn't matter. Everything requires the same steps, which is that preemptive review of all the relevant documents. So last but not least, let's quickly talk about the big heist. I don't know how many people are familiar with Dave Chase and his project between books and movies and stories online and articles and postings. It all falls under the Big Heist umbrella. Dave Chase is collecting all this information from lots of industry experts and putting it all together. And there are these stories that we've been either brought to his attention or that have been brought to our attention regarding these excessive charges and costs. I won't blame you. I won't bore you with the details, but at your leisure, feel free to read this. But this is just one example of why, you know, this can't just be an intellectual or academic discussion. It actually has to be the first step towards taking action. Hopefully, some of these ideas that we've shared with you today, don't be influenced by the name of the movie. Just because your favorite Schwarzenegger movie is Terminator doesn't mean you need to apply that type of reference-based pricing. I know I get influenced that way, too. But hopefully this helps you to really kind of wrap your arms around it and understand the different options that are out there, and also understand there's a broad spectrum. For those who are not as risk-loving as the people who want to go commando and just do all-in reference-based pricing with nothing else, it doesn't mean that you can't do it. It doesn't mean that there aren't other options available to you. It's up to you. It's up to your plan administrator to decide how risk-loving or risk-averse they are and determine whether there's an option out there that's attractive to them. But at the end of the day, just doing nothing is still doing something, and it's not something that I suggest doing.
Wow.
That was my Dr. Seuss for the day. You're welcome. So with that, I just want to thank everybody who dialed in. Again, be sure to reach out to us with questions and concerns, PDC referral. Check out the website for all the media access. Download our webinar. Additionally, we have another webinar coming up July 13th. Should be enough time to get over the holiday, get the firework ashes out of your eyes, and focus in on some awesome slides, and particularly some more of those shirtless slides. So on behalf of myself, John, Brady, Jen, the entire Fiat Group crew, thank you for joining us once again. Love talking to you. Anyone who has any topics, concerns, or ideas they want to share for future webinars, you know where to reach us. We love you all very much, and have a great weekend.